From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from two people behind the TV series Pushing Daisies, which is up for 12 Emmys Sunday night. The creator, Brian Fuller, and director Barry Sonnenfeld. The first season of Pushing Daisies is now out on DVD. Also, Mike Myers joins us. He created the swinging spy Austin Powers and his arch-nemesis Dr. Evil. On Saturday Night Live, his characters included three TV talk hosts: the slacker teen of Wayne's World, the German hipster of Sprockets, and the verklempt Linda Richman of Coffee Talk. His latest film, The Love Guru, has just come out on video. And film critic David Edelstein reviews two independent films, Towelhead and Hound Dog. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Pushing Daisies, the ABC series about a pie maker with a touch that can restore life, is up for 12 Emmys Sunday night. Also, the show's first season came out on DVD this week, and the second season begins October 1st. Today, we'll talk with Brian Fuller, the creator of the show, and Barry Sonnenfeld, the director of the pilot episode. Both of them are nominated for Emmys. Barry Sonnenfeld also directed the Addams Family and Men in Black films, as well as Get Shorty. He started his career as a cinematographer and shot several films for the Coen brothers, including Blood Simple and Miller's Crossing. Brian Fuller broke into TV by writing for two series in the Star Trek franchise. Then he created the cult TV shows Wonderfalls and Dead Like Me, and also wrote and produced for Heroes. Pushing Daisies revolves around a young man named Ned, played by Lee Pace, who's also up for an Emmy. Ned has the unusual and unexplained gift of bringing dead people back to life with a single touch. Here's a scene from the pilot, which is now out on DVD. Ned works with a private detective on unsolved murders. Their current case is the murder of Ned's childhood sweetheart, a woman nicknamed Chuck. In a funeral home, Ned awakens Chuck from the dead. But unless he touches her again within a minute and takes her life away for good, someone else will die.
Chuck, wait!
Who are you?
Do you remember the little boy who lived next door to you when your dad died?
Ned? Oh my God, hey, how are you?
Good, you look great. Do you know what's happening right now?
I had the strangest dream. I was being strangled to death with a plastic sack.
You were strangled to death with a plastic sack. That's probably an odd thing to hear, but I wasn't quite sure how to sugarcoat it.
Oh.
You only have a minute, less.
What can I do in less than a minute?
You can tell me who killed you, so, you know, justice can be served.
Well, that's really sweet, but I don't know who killed me. I went to go get ice, and I dropped my room key in the ice maker, and as I was thinking, that was dumb.
As she was thinking that was dumb, Chuck was strangled to death with a plastic sack.
And then you touched my cheek.
What's going on here?
Just a second!
Is my time up?
I'm sorry.
Well, thanks for calling me Chuck. Do you know no one's called me Chuck since you?
I used to. When I lived next door to you, I had a crush. I was in. You were my first kiss.
Yeah? You were my first kiss, too. You want to be my last kiss? First and last? Or is that weird?
That's not weird. It's symmetrical.
I spoke with Barry Sonnenfeld and Brian Fuller last fall and began by asking Brian Fuller to describe the premise of Pushing Daisies.
The story is about a young man named Ned who is a pie maker, and he discovers as a child that he has a gift that he can touch dead things and bring them back to life. But this gift has a caveat or two, and those caveats are if he touches the dead once, they come back to life. If he touches them again, they go back to being dead and dead again forever, never to be revived. And the third caveat is if he lets a dead person live for longer than a minute, then someone else has to die. And he decides in our pilot that his childhood sweetheart, when she dies, she deserves to be brought back for good and makes a decision to let somebody die to get his lost love back.
Now, every time I describe this to people, after telling them that I think it's my favorite new show of the fall, they look at me like I'm slightly deranged. But once you get past that initial description, can you talk about why it is that you're able to hit grace notes that make this more intelligent and witty and less just sci-fi strange than it sounds?
I think it just goes to the characters and the character relationships. So we're all wanting to be in relationships, and we all want someone to love in our lives, and all those relationships are going to come with complications. And if the basic complication is that you can't touch each other, then it forces you to get to know somebody and be intimate in a way where you don't have the hurdle of physicality to get over, because it's never an option.
Part of what's so charming about the pilot is the visual look which Barry, you bring to it as the director, or are greatly involved in bringing it as the director. How do you collaborate together and with the costume designer and with the lighting designer and with the actors even to make sure that everybody's on a uniform tone for something that's kind of like a fable.
Well, for me, and this is Barry talking, for me, the definition of a director is a sort of the tone police, and a director has to decide what the tone of a show is going to be and then make sure everything is consistent to that tone, whether it be the lighting, the camera angles, the nature of the way actors talk, the pace in which they talk, the way the camera covers the way those people talk, the costumes they wear. And again, based on Brian's script, the tone to me was quite obvious, although I will say that the tone is a very narrow bridge to walk on in this show, that it could have gotten too jokey or too sad or too silly. So Brian's script sort of defined the tone. It was my job with Brian to maintain that tone in everything from visual effects to camera angles to lighting. But that's the job of a director.
And why the focus on so many stage actors? This is by no means a complaint, but you have Kristen Chenoweth, Swoozie Kurtz, Ellen Green, some really remarkable talent there in supporting roles.
It really wasn't any sort of intentional agenda to get a lot of stage actors. I think it was the training of stage performers is more conducive to the tone of the show. And you know, I used to work on Star Trek for many years, and we often found that since Star Trek was a heightened reality, that we would cast a lot of stage actors because they found a way to make that heightened reality emotionally real. And so with Kristen and Swoozie and Ellen and Anna and Lee, who all have a lot of stage training, they made the heightened reality real.
Barry, let me ask you a question about the Coen brothers. You started as a cinematographer on Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, which is one of my absolute favorites. And I'm wondering, did you develop and absorb their style, or did they develop and absorb yours?
Joel and Ethan Coen and I worked on our first three movies together. In fact, the first time I had ever been on a movie set in my life, or the Coen brothers in their lives, was the first day on the set shooting Blood Simple. None of us worked our way up. We just sort of got lucky and raised some money and made the movie. And I had done a lot of still photography work before that and loved the wide-angle lens. I thought it had a real energy to it. And so we developed a look together, and, you know, I learned a lot from them and they learned a lot from me, but it was really incredibly collaborative, very much the way it is now with Brian and myself on Pushing Daisies.
One thing that you do in your films as director that seems to carry on to the television program is to trust your actors a great deal, to have some scenes go in wide frame where we get to see what two or three of them are doing at a time, and to trust them to act. Is that an accurate assessment, and is that something that you're doing intentionally?
That's an incredibly astute question, and I'm going to take a minute to answer that. First of all, I think great comedy plays in two shot because you have action and reaction in the same shot. If you look at all the screwball comedies by Preston Sturges or Howard Hawks, you've got Cary Grant in a bathrobe, and you've got Katharine Hepburn calling him Mr. Bones, which isn't his name, and bringing up Baby. And the only reason, or part of the reason that works, is because it plays out in a two-shot. You have Cary Grant reacting while Katharine Hepburn is being hysterical in the same shot. It requires really good writing, first of all, so that you don't need to cover the scene in order to edit out the bad words or the stuff that you cringe when you read it going to work that morning. And then, in addition, the director has to pace the actors to give you the comic pacing in that shot, so you don't have to try to pace up the scene later by covering the close-ups. But I find a lot of comedies are shot in a really lazy style with a lot of close-ups, and I never want to cut to the punchline of a joke. I want the audience to think they're smarter than me, mm-hmm. so that they see where the joke is, and it's as if they don't even know that I knew where the joke was. I like them to discover where the joke is.
My guests are Brian Fuller, the creator of Pushing Daisies, and Barry Sonnenfeld, the director. They're both executive producers. What were the first movies or TV shows you saw that really sparked your imagination?
I would say one of the biggest influences on my writing and imagination was The Twilight Zone. It's, you know, very often they were one-act plays that had characters that were reacting very realistically to incredibly absurd situations, and they always kind of had an emotional realism to them, but we were allowed to see this fantastic world that wasn't contained within the parameters of reality.
Well, Barry, same question to you.
I came very late to movies because I had this painfully shy childhood. I wasn't a movie goer. I was profoundly thin, couldn't get a date, and didn't want to go to movies by myself. And B, the only thing you would see at movies was people falling in love and having dates and getting married. So, and I knew that wasn't going to happen to me either. So I came very, very late to movies, and the movie that to this day is my favorite movie that was one of the first movies I saw was Dr. Strangelove.
Oh,
which
wow.
is, as black a comedy. You never want to tell anyone you're making a black comedy because the studios never want to make black comedies. I remember trying to get a movie made at Paramount after Addams Family did over $100 million, and the head of the studio was saying, well, you know, we don't make black comedies here. And I said, well, kind of Addams Family. So, but I'm a big black comedy fan, and Strangelove is my favorite movie.
Well, that's really interesting, because Kubrick films most of the scenes in Strangelove in exactly the way that you've described as you preferring to set up your comedy scenes.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. One of the things that makes Strangelove so great is to see Sterling Hayden and Peter Sellers in the same frame, looking in the same direction with Jack D. Ripper explaining why, you can't drink water and milk and, you know, the whole purity of essence mm-hmm. thing. So that movie is often played in the Comedy 2 shot, and what makes it hysterical is seeing action and reaction in that same shot. So when I mentioned Howard Hawks and Preston Sturges, I should have also mentioned Kubrick as he directed Strangelove.
Brian Fuller, creator of the ABC TV series Pushing Daisies, and Barry Sonnenfeld, director of the show's pilot, in a conversation from last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 2007 interview with Brian Fuller, creator of the TV series Pushing Daisies, and film director Barry Sonnenfeld, who directed it. Your jobs, your first jobs in what we could call show business.
I know where this is going, Dave.
You don't even know.
That's so cheap, Dave.
You don't even know to whom this question is directed yet, because both of you guys broke in, if my information is correct, in fairly unorthodox and very different fashions. And I was just going to ask, who wants to go first?
I want Brian to go first.
I started in porn. And that's actually a segue into Barry's story, yeah. So I'll let him go. That was very passive-aggressive of me.
And I wasn't going to mention it. When I got out of film school, I thought I had some talent as a cinematographer, so I thought if I owned a camera, I could call myself a cameraman without being sort of effete about it. So I bought a used 16mm camera, and the first job I got was shooting 9 feature-length pornos in 9 days. The 9 days were so sexually disgusting, perverse, and, my theory is if porns included the sense of smell, no one would ever go see a porn again.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So Blood Simple would be the first thing on your resume.
Actually, Blood Simple would be the second thing. I shot a documentary called In Our Water.
That
Academy Award. No. I love documentaries, and in fact, it helped me discover a certain style of shooting involving sort of wide-angle lenses, and it's a different way of shooting documentaries. But Blood Simple was the first time I was a cinematographer on a feature film for the Coen brothers.
But didn't you get
in Austin, Texas?
Didn't you get Blood Simple because of your work on the documentary, though?
Oh, no. I got job on Blood Simple because Joel Coen and myself were the only two Jews at a party filled with wasps on the Upper East Side one night. And we sort of smelled each other from across the room and came together. And we discovered that we had both gone to NYU film school, although we didn't know each other then. And he was telling me that he had just written a script for Blood Simple, and he was going to shoot a trailer as if it was a finished film and use that as a technique to raise money. And I said, hey, I own a camera. And he hired me that night, and we went off and shot the trailer of that would have become the trailer for Blood Simple. And a year later, we were on a movie set. But no, it was merely because I owned a camera that Joel Coen found me that night and hired me.
Wow. Which scenes were used in the trailer?
Well, because we didn't have any actors yet, you know, because we hadn't raised the money, it was shot in a very sort of stylized way. So we shot the yellow lines of a road. And you know the scene near the end of Blood Simple where Emmett Walsh shoots holes through the bathroom.
Oh, yes, sure.
Wall, and you see those beams of light. So we recreated that, but we didn't have what are called squibs or any explosives. So we cut big round holes in a wall and then patched them up again. And then while I dollied in on the wall, a guy in the back, Don Wigman, behind the wall, was hitting the holes with a hammer. And that's how we created. The plugs went out so fast, you didn't see them in the darkness. So, the funny thing is, we then shot Blood Simple and had a real professional guy with squibs and explosives, and we set the holes according to a specific pattern, and it didn't look nearly as good as it did as compared to Don Wigman with a hammer in the back of the wall.
and Brian, if you still remember the question,
asked Dave.
Yes, I'd like you to answer it in terms of no. I'm just saying the way that you broke into the business was very unusual. It may have smelled better, but.
it was much more olfactory friendly. I submitted a spec script to Star Trek Deep Space Nine and got invited in to pitch. So there was a time when Star Trek had an open script submission policy, at which they which went away shortly afterwards because of the lawsuits. But I managed to get in under the gun with folks like Ronald Moore, who reimagined Battlestar Galactica for the Sci-Fi Channel, and it was a great way to get into writing. And it just I saw the show, I liked the show a lot, and I decided to write a spec script, and I did, and it got me in the door, and I sold a couple of stories, and then they gave me a script, and I was on staff for 4 years.
Can you define what a spec script is?
Oh, a spec script is something that you write that you're not getting paid for, and oftentimes writers will use them as a resume. It's a sample of your work that shows that you can actually write a script, and there's two ways to do it. You can either write an original spec script, which is basically a pilot that hasn't been ordered, but a pilot that you would like to see and like to write. And the other one is to look at a show, an existing show like Desperate Housewives or Ugly Betty, and write an episode that you come up with and give it to people. So it's a writing sample.
And what did you learn most in terms of doing television, and specifically fanciful television?
I got into writing to become a Star Trek writer. I was a rabid fan. I had shelves and shelves and shelves of action figures in my bedroom that scared away more dates than I care to admit to. And so it was really, if back then you told me you're going to write for Star Trek for 20 years, I couldn't have imagined a happier career. But after writing for Star Trek for 4 years and bumping up against the parameters of the storytelling, which sometimes were very restrictive because there was always that magical reset button and you could never carry story arcs over the episodes because they were so heavily syndicated that it just simply wasn't allowed. I began to get itchy and wanting to tell stories with a little more emotional depth, because one of the things about the Star Trek universe, especially the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager, were that the characters were so much more evolved than we were that they wouldn't be terrified when they're looking at a giant Borg cube about to assimilate them. They would handle their jobs and they would behave responsibly and calmly. And I just had a hard time relating to that after a certain point. And then my last year on Voyager, I wrote Dead Like Me on spec.
Brian Fuller, Barry Sonnenfeld, thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave.
Brian Fuller and Barry Sonnenfeld in a conversation from last fall. Both of them are up for Emmy Awards Sunday for their work on Pushing Daisies. The first season of that ABC comedy series has just come out on DVD. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, 5 generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, whose 4-day poetry festival starts September 25th in Waterloo Village, New Jersey, at dodgepoetryfestival.org. And from Nasiri, presenting the Love Sees No Color CD and bonus DVD to support the Love Sees No Color Foundation at nasiri.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Mike Myers gets a little verklempt. Also, David Edelstein reviews 2 independent films that explore adolescent sexuality, Towelhead and Hound Dog. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. The Love Guru was released on DVD this week. It features the first original character created for the movies by Mike Myers since he came up with Austin Powers and all the colorful alter egos for that series of film comedies. When Mike Myers was a cast member of Saturday Night Live from 1989 to 1995, he became famous for his sketches like Wayne's World, Coffee Talk with Linda Richman, and Sprockets. In his 3 Austin Powers movies, he played both the swingin' super spy and his arch-rival Dr. Evil. His newest big-screen effort, The Love Guru, is built around a character he's been developing for years, Guru Pitka. Pitka has a ritzy ashram in L.A., where many celebrities come to seek enlightenment. The character is, in part, a comic tribute to Deepak Chopra, whom Myers describes as a close friend. In fact, Myers wrote the introduction to Chopra's new novel about a comic, a character who bears some similarities to Myers. Let's listen to Terry's interview with Mike Myers, recorded this summer, when The Love Guru was first released. But first, here's a scene from The Love Guru. It's a flashback. The young Pitka, who is still known by his American name Maurice, is in India, sitting at the feet of his guru, along with another young acolyte. The guru is played by Ben Kingsley.
Deepak, why do you want to join the Thagin Maipuda ashram?
To seek my true self.
Maurice, why do you want to join?
I want to become a guru so girls will like me. Then I will like myself.
Deepak, you will enjoy love in all forms. Maurice,
you must wear this chastity belt.
Chastity belt? That sucks!
Mike Myers, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a real pleasure to have you here. Let me start by asking you to describe the character of Guru Pitka.
Well, the character is, he's an American who was raised in an ashram in India, and he is taught a non-denominational, fictional belief system, kind of like the Force in Star Wars, called drama. And he's taught in the ways of drama by his guru, the guru Thagin Maipuda, who is played by Sir Ben Kingsley. And he's the number two guru in the United States, number two self-help spiritualist in the United States. Number one is Deepak Chopra, and he lives in his shadow.
Now, Guru Pitka has a self-help book for every problem in the world. What are some of the titles of his books?
I Know You Are, But What Am I? Another book he has about self-talk is called Stop Hitting Yourself. Stop Hitting Yourself. And he has a book on the grieving process called What's This? A Dead One of These.
And I like, if you're happy and you know it, think again.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
Did you read a lot of those books before writing the movie?
In 1991, my father passed away. Two things emerged creatively for me. One was Austin Powers. My parents are from Liverpool, England. My dad used to literally wake me up at night, even on a school night, to watch British comedies. So Austin Powers is a tribute to all the British comedies that my father made me watch, in essence. I'm glad he did. And the Guru Pitka is started as a way of dealing with that loss of, it kind of rocked my world. I didn't understand why the universe would take away the one guy I wanted to see all of this amazing success that was happening, all of my dreams, more than my dreams, because I never thought it would go this well. He died in 91, and I just started reading. I started reading things philosophical, things spiritual. And this is something I've been working on for many, many years. I wanted to have a very silly delivery system for some ideas that I actually believe in.
So you were raised in part on British comedies. You say your father used to wake you up in the middle of the night to show them to you.
He would be like, ooh, there's something really funny. And I'd be like half asleep in my Jimmy Jams. And I knew I had like a math test in the morning. He'd go, well, you can study the math test in the morning. This is really funny. It's Peter Sellers and I'm All Right, Jack, and you'll love it. And I would wake up, and he'd make me a cup of tea to wake me up. He's like, ooh, let's make some tea and watch Peter Sellers. And it's one of my happiest memories. It was an amazing bond, you know, with my father, you know.
What about James Bond films? Like, how were you first exposed to them?
Well, of course, he was British. And so my dad, you know, British people are, there's nobody more English than an Englishman who no longer lives in England. And so he lived in Canada, and his house looked like a house in Liverpool. It was like Canadian on the outside and you know, filled with, you know, brass horses and figurines and you know, pictures of Liverpool and stuff. James Bond was British. My dad loved Sean Connery. He loved Michael Caine. Michael Caine because he had a working class accent. Most actors were like, hello, I say, how are you? I'm from England. And my dad had a Liverpool accent, like, you know, great, love it, wonderful. He would say the word squirrel, squiddle. And I'd go, hold on, There's not that many L's in that word. Squiddle, Kuchbuch, Squiddle. And, you know, Michael Caine was one of the first people with a working-class regional accent to be in the movies. Sean Connery was just British cool. Just, he's British. We're so happy he's, you know what I mean? And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you're endowed with, you know?
So let me play a scene from Austin Powers, and this is from the first Austin Powers film. And Austin Powers is on the trail of Dr. Evil, and he's with a fellow spy, a beautiful spy, of course, played by Elizabeth Hurley. Mm-hmm. And they're pretending to be husband and wife so that they could check into the hotel together, and here they are having just checked into their room.
So, which side of the bed do you want?
You're sleeping on the sofa, Mr. Powers. In fact, I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that the only reason we're sharing a room is to keep up the context that we're a married couple on vacation.
Right. Shall we shag now or shall we shag later? How do you like to do it? Do you like to wash up first? You know, top and tails, whore's bath. Personally, before I'm on the job, I like to give my undercarriage a bit of a how's your father.
That's so funny. Mike Myers and Elizabeth Hurley in the first Austin Powers film. And I should say, in that scene, you're wearing an orange jacket, multicolored striped pants, and a blue polka dot shirt.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how did you come up with words like, you know, deciding you were going to use shag a lot and shagadelic?
Me and my brothers are the only people in my gene pool who are not from Liverpool. I have a couple of cousins who are just north of London, but they were all from Liverpool, and they would say things like shag and randy, and you know, the genesis. Everything evolves. The first time I did a character that was like Austin Powers, I did it on stage, and it was a parody of all those British shows where really, really enthusiastic scientists would tell you how everything's made, and so it was a show called This Is How It's Made. And so I would show, like, this is a clothes washer, and here we have the barrel that the clothes go in and a piston that goes up and down. Does that make you horny? Does it? That piston, does it make you randy? To you, is it Eros Manifest? And that's where that crazy riff came from, and it just really made the audience uncomfortable. and that just was that thing of the 60s and everything that was sexualized, eroticized. There were sexy jobs, being a stewardess, sexy countries, Sweden, you know? And just how one day that just didn't happen anymore. And that's really the genesis of Austin Powers, is whatever happened to swingers. I literally was driving home from hockey practice and I heard The Look of Love by Burt Bacharach and went, what happened to swingers?
I like in Mel Brooks's movies, a lot of his movies are based on the premise, like, if Mel Brooks was back in history, what would mm-hmm. history be like? You know, mm-hmm. if Mel Brooks was a romantic lead, what would that be like? Did you feel that way about Austin Powers? If Mike Myers was this kind of like international spy, a man of mystery, what would he be like?
Well, I would be operating from a tremendous amount of low self-esteem and unprocessed wounding. It's funny. When I started going out with girls, it was just right at the end of the sexual revolution. So I watched my older brothers, and I was like, wow, this is great. I can't wait. And then it was like, wah, 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 but not for you. You know? That looks great when you're 11. It's like, wow, I can't wait. You know, that'll be awesome. They were like on the game show and it's a brand new car. I get on the game show and it's a donkey. Wah, wah, wah. So it is a little bit of a fantasy realized. But, you know, the main thing that's interesting, you know, the Austin Powers, the reason, in my opinion, and this is the dramatic thesis, if you will, of a very, very broad and silly comedy, and everything I do is broad and silly. I try and give it an underpinning of something that is on my mind. But ultimately, the delivery system is very broad and silly. But my belief is that The sexual revolution didn't end because of a sexual counter-revolution. I don't think the right had anything to do with it, the moral right or whatever you want to call them. I think what happens is that that kind of swinging is an unsustainable lifestyle. I think when people cheat, it hurts their feelings. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that...
Yes.
I, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I think that kind of stuff hurts. There's a hangover. There's an aftertaste. There's a price to be paid.
So were you scarred
so
by...
So true love triumphs over lust is the message of Austin Powers.
So were you scarred by missing the sexual revolution?
I felt a little ripped off, yes. It, it didn't seem at all fair.
Mike Myers, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from earlier this year with Mike Myers, writer and star of The Love Guru. The movie has just come out on DVD.
Now, there was a period when I was sure you were Jewish, even though it turns out you were raised Protestant. But I think I thought you were Jewish because you did the Linda Richman character so well on Saturday Night Live. And she was the Jewish woman from New York with the big 80s eyeglasses and the bouffant hair that you keep fluffing with her hands. And her conversation always had Yiddish words in it, like verklempt and spilkes. And, where did that come from?
Well, when I grew up in Toronto, you would hear in culture, like even the Indians in F Troop were like, I'm an Indian, you know. This is Meshuggah, you know. You know, as a comedy fan, you know, everybody, you know, Phil Silvers. See, this is my father was like, people weren't American, they weren't Canadian, they weren't English, they were from Showbiznia. But, you know, Bing Crosby was from Showbiznia.
Right.
And you just hear an accent that is New York, and I'm guessing now New York Jewish, could be New York Italian, it's hard to know, and... When I came to New York, I couldn't believe that that accent existed in nature and that it wasn't just a literary convention. And it all came down to hearing somebody say, would you like a coffee? A coffee. And I thought, K-A-U-P-H-Y, coffee. You mean coffee? And it was daughter's dog's coffee, you know, no big whoop. And it's mellifluous, and it's because of comedy culture, it's familiar and it's comforting. The language of Yiddish is, I guess it's onomatopoetic, you know, to say something is drek. Actually, the word Shrek is Yiddish for scare. Ugh, I got such a Shrek. And now that I live in New York and have since 1989, it's the language of my people, I feel. I get very happy when I travel abroad and I hear, you know, dog's daughter, coffee. And, you know, since I'm 12, pocketbook, online, all of these things that remind me of what is now my home, which is New York City, you know.
What did you love about expressions like verklempt? Like, I can't talk now, I'm getting verklempt.
I'm getting a little verklempt. It sounds like it is. You know, you go into somebody's house and it's schmeck, which means clean. They keep a very schmeck house. Although there's not enough windows, it's a little finster, which is dark. Nishta heina, nishta here. That's another one I love.
For neither here nor there.
You know. Yeah, it's nishta heina, nishta here. And geg isn't to hate. Sheket bevakasha. These are the things. It feels closer to the sentiment. It's
Does verklempt means I'm getting choked up?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then some stuff I made up, like Spilkes is real, but Genek the Gazoink is not. You know, he has Spilkes in his Genek the Gazoink. I'm getting a little verklempt when I talk about him. He's in Boca Raton,
He's recovering nicely, but he has spilkes in his gnechtegezoink.
Now, you were a child performer. I mean, you were in commercials starting when you were 9 or 10. Did you get the kind of training that, like a lot of kids in the 60s, and maybe in the 70s too, were trained as if they were old vaudevillians? You know, like they would need to tap dance and sing and and do comedy and acting. Were you trained to do all of that?
I wasn't. You know, Conan O'Brien, when I first got on the show, because he was a writer on Saturday Night Live, he looked at me and he said, "You're from olden days. You're from yesteryear." And I went, "I guess I am. I don't know. I just recently, PBS had a pledge, and they had the singing and dancing documentary. And I was watching, you know, An American in Paris and Gigi. And I was like, God, I want to make a movie like that. And then I thought, of course, not at that level of skill. But in my own way, I did sort of make movies like that. There is dancing in Austin Powers and in The
Love
Guru.
There's a little Singing in the Rain tribute.
Yeah, I'm just saying, it's like, you know, I think I'm old school that way. I think the training I did as an actor as a child ultimately is irrelevant to what I did in my adult years. I think it's night and day. I think, you know, when you're a little kid, it's the isn't it great that he can do that for a little kid? And then once you hit 18, there's no for a little kid, you know, disclaimer attached to it. I loved doing it as a kid. It was very, very interesting. My real training began at Saturday Night Live.
What's the worst thing that happened to you live on Saturday Night Live? The thing that really caught you up short?
On Sprockets, it was Dieter's dance party. And Lauren said, if you can take 2 minutes out of the sketch gets in. And he said this with, the show's at 11:30, he said this at 11:10. So I ran, broadcast news style, to the PAs, and I made cuts. And it went from Dieter's dance party top 10 to Dieter's dance party top 5. And they still hadn't changed the cue cards. And so some dude was behind the cue card guy, sweat, buckets of sweat, changing the cue cards, because you can never really memorize your lines at Saturday Night Live because they change all the time because of standards and practices and Lauren's notes between dress and air. And I had to stall at one point. I go, number 3, you know, who are you to accuse me, or whatever the name of the song was. Number 4, and the dude was furiously writing on the card, Schreibmaschine by the Love People, or whatever the name it was. The other thing was, when I did Wayne's World, it was a cold opening. It was the day that the Gulf War broke out. It was being changed 33 seconds up into air because we wanted to make sure that if the invasion, the first Gulf War, was going to be horrendous casualties, that we would be sensitive to the people in the armed forces. So anything that we thought might suggest, I don't know, being anything other than appreciative of the men in the armed services, we cut with 33 seconds to go to a live show. So that those are the two moments that were very significant to me. I've also cracked my head a million times backstage.
Really?
My body is mostly, oh, sure. Because I go night blind. You know, it's very, very bright lights. And then you go backstage to make a quick change. And I can't see anything. Literally, they have to, you know, pull me by the hand. I've, like, cut open my hand. My head is mostly scar tissue now.
Have you been bleeding live on the air?
Yes, I have. And then you just have to put the bleeding hand downstage behind your back.
Seriously? Yeah?
Oh, many times. I get very nervous, or not, or it's adrenaline. And sometimes you cut yourself, you don't even know it.
Right.
And I've, like, knocked out teeth. I've got a scar over my right eye. My hand is all cut up. Many, 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 many quick change accidents.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Not at all. My pleasure.
Mike Myers speaking to Terry Gross last June. The Love Guru is now out on DVD. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews two new movies, Towelhead and Hound Dog. This is Fresh Air. two movies in limited release explore the topic of underage rape. Towelhead, set in suburbia in the early 90s, is directed by Alan Ball, whose movie American Beauty examined that same place and time. Hound Dog is set in the 50s in the rural South and stars Dakota Fanning as a 13-year-old who worships Elvis Presley. Our film critic, David Edelstein, reviews both.
Underage girls are raped in Towelhead and Hound Dog, and while both films condemn the act, obviously, the approaches are so different, it's worth going beyond the moralizing to consider their ways of framing the violation. Towelhead is a faithful adaptation of Alicia Arian's novel about a 13-year-old mixed-race girl, Jazeera, played by Summer Bishel. Men have started sniffing around her. Her mother's boyfriend volunteers to shave her pubic hair, which results in her being punished, sent off to live in the Houston suburbs with her Lebanese dad. Men of all ages and cultures project on Jazeera like crazy. Her father slaps her when she wears a revealing outfit. Her neighbor, a racist military reservist played by Aaron Eckhart, shares his porn magazines. She likes them. She might like him until he goes too far. It's incendiary material, but director Alan Ball cools it down and keeps it at an ironic distance. He presents Jazeera as a ripe sexual object. And as I watched, I didn't know how to feel. Ball wants to suggest the girl's mixture of victimization and, on some level, sexual excitement, a mixture that's finally irreconcilable. But in Arian's novel, that detached tone comes across as Jazeera's way of protecting herself, to keep from disintegrating as her natural desires are turned against her. Ball's detachment feels clinical. It deadens the audience. The press dubbed Deborah Campmeyer's Hound Dog the Dakota Fanning rape film, and rumors of its subject provoked denunciations and even death threats. But whatever else it is or isn't, Hound Dog is not remotely exploitive. It's an allegory of subjugation and emancipation, of liberation through art. It unfolds in the 50s in rural Alabama, a lazy and beautiful but dangerous place, where Fanning's prepubescent Llewellyn literally shakes off the oppression of her brutal father, played by David Morse, and her puritanical grandmother, played by Piper Laurie. She sings Elvis Presley's Hound Dog and wriggles her body. Her renditions are goofy and unself-conscious and blissful.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never gonna rub it in. You ain't no friend of mine. Well, they said you was high class, but that was just a lie. Well, they said you was high class, but that was just a lie. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine. You
ain't not a When a little playmate says he can get her a ticket to an Elvis concert, she eagerly follows him into a barn where a teenage boy waits in the shadows. The rape isn't explicit, and Llewellyn endures it with an air of disbelief. Her powerlessness takes a while to sink in. The focus of Hound Dog isn't child rape, any more than Elvis worship. It opens, too heavy-handedly, with a snake sliding up a branch, and serpents are everywhere. But Campmeyer finds a way to turn the clunky symbols inside out, literally. Although Llewellyn never tells anyone what happened, a black caretaker, played by Afemo Omalami, finds out and sees how she's shut down and stopped singing. When he tries to engage her, she calls him the N-word, and he says they both are that. Both have been demeaned and poisoned. He guts a rattler and squeezes out its venom, and the metaphor is right there. The poison can be used. Maybe Llewellyn will never sing Hound Dog with the same childish abandon, but she might if she can muster the courage, come closer to the meaning of the song. She could sing it like the blues. It's easy to criticize Hound Dog for being too obvious, and Campmeyer could have been craftier in making the black man more of an individual than a healing angel. But the film is haunting anyway. Fanning is a child actor with a grown-up soul, and every move, every breath, seems mysteriously right. Early on, you're torn between elation at her openness and the urge to cry a warning. Those conflicting feelings are never resolved. But the movie does suggest a means of transcendence through art and pop culture, whereas Talhead hides behind fashionable cynicism. Both films, however, pose the same urgent question. How can any girl navigate this over-sexualized culture without giving up something of herself? However much we think we've advanced, the question lingers, crying out to be transformed into works like these.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hirschfeld. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from MasterCard. World MasterCard is designed to give you access to a world of possibilities. Learn more at priceless.com/world. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review. Online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The AMC cable series Mad Men is up for 16 Emmy nominations. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mad Men creator and executive producer Matthew Weiner and cast members John Hamm and John Slattery. Join us for the next Fresh Air.